my choice of beverage.
What are we doing? Episode 015.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 15. So we picked this song with a very specific purpose in mind.
Sorry.
The little chorus coming up here is the key. Like, this is it, right? Here
right,
it goes.
Here you go.
Nope.
No. Sorry. Oh. Fake this out.
Verse 2.
Yeah.
Or verse 1B or something. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about vision. We're going to be talking about casting a vision or some elements around vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought this song is a good primer. Or to prime our pump a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
When did this song come out? It's like late 70s. I remember this thing on the radio. Good old Eddie Money. I love Eddie Money. I started listening to him again lately, just listening to a bunch of albums. This specific album is really good. I think it's just called Eddie Money, I think. It's just feel-good, solid band-style rock and roll. It's just good stuff. Just Eddie Money, right?
This is from his debut album, titled Eddie Money.
He crushed it.
1977.
So I would have been...
This song was released in June of 78.
Okay.
So...
All right. So,
but the album came out in 77.
So I would have been 10 years old. In 78, I was 10 years old.
The same time that Star Wars A New Hope came out.
The second one. No, the first one?
The very first movie, yeah.
For some reason, I thought it was 76, but... Okay.
77.
78. 77, 78. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember it vividly.
Yeah. Well, a little shout-out here.
There you go.
TTX. TTX right there, sipping from a coffee cup. Put up here in this one. All right. A little TTX action. Of course... last episode, we talked to Brandon Kenny, CEO, TTX. Great conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Many to come with him.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm using his coffee cup, which is awesome.
Just as a reminder, you two will be going through the book by...
That's right. Doris Kearns Goodwin. I have this.
Right here.
Team Arrivals. There it is. We've gotten through some of it. A little
bit of it.
Little side note is you and I are crushing it on the audio, and poor Brandon is struggling to keep up. But so I've kind of paused in reading, waiting for him to catch up, which is bugging me. I'm like, man, he just got the nomination where I'm at for the Republican Party. So
I actually went back and started. I was done with Chapter 6. Went back to Chapter 5 again. I'm listening to it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes when I'm driving around to listen to audiobooks, I zone out.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I'm like,
where am I? What town am I in? I think I missed my exit. Yeah.
So that happens.
Well, so I want to talk about vision a little bit. Vision's a big deal. And it is one of those, to use Eddie Money, it's a kind of a money word. But it's lost its meaning.
I see what you did there.
I didn't mean to. It's lost its meaning. Like, so when you say vision, you know, people think of, I don't know what. I mean, people think all kinds of things. It's kind of one of those fill in the blank words. You know, it's just like, I love lifesavers and I love my wife and I love looking at the stars. Mm-hmm. And it's the same word and it has some, The speaker has lots of latent meaning behind the word, but the recipient is kind of going, well, now, which love are you talking about? You know what I mean? And there's this big, wide spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think vision's one of those words. It's one of those words that can mean so much.
Mm-hmm.
And when somebody who needs to wield that word uses it, I think they make a mistake perhaps just by using that word, but secondly, often overlook the fact that the listener, the recipient, or the person on the other side of the word doesn't know what the speaker means.
For sure.
Yeah.
There's...
So I was driving in this morning, and I was listening to another podcast. What was it? Andy Stanley.
Yeah.
Good client friend of not Andy Stanley is not a good client friend. What I'm misspeaking here. What I meant to say was Josh Gordon, Full Spectrum Marketing, who was, I think he was episode 2 or 3 or something. Loves listening to Andy Stanley. I never have. And I was looking around for wondering if anybody out there was talking about vision in podcasts. Came across a bunch of stuff that is all over the map, from ooey gooey kind of like the universe, speak it and it will be kind of, you know, hippie vision stuff. I don't know how else to call that. And all the hippies out there, like, hey, you know.
Hey.
But all the way from that to where are you taking this business and everywhere in between, you know. So, anyway, he has a book called, I think, Visioneering. Is that right?
Yeah.
Which sounds really interesting. I've never read it. But he talked about it a little bit in this podcast. Anyway, so I pulled in the driveway here at Lodestone True North, the home of Lodestone True North. I guess I repeated myself.
You did.
You know, where we're taking businesses from broken to smoking. We're helping business leaders and businesses by guiding them to their land of awesome. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today, which is vision, which I repurpose, or I kind of recoined, or thought about, hey, how do I describe vision to a business owner, a leadership team, in a way that isn't ooey gooey, fill in the blank, hey, y'all have 5 different meanings of the word, and that's fine.
It's kind of one of those words that your imagination kind of just runs a little either wild or amok.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that. So when I pulled in, sat in the parking lot earlier this morning, just making some notes and thinking and processing, I was listening to some good music. I was actually listening to Toto.
Can't go wrong there.
And I wrote down what came to mind as maybe, I guess I'd use the word synonym. And I just kind of, you know, wrote a few. It's like wish. You know, so vision, you know, I wish this were true. I hope this were true. Imagination is one of those words. You said the word imagination. So people can imagine something like, wouldn't it be nice if... So I went to the car show the other day.
Yeah, that's right.
Father's Day was the other day. And here in Northeast Ohio, there's a great Father's Day car show at Stan Hewitt.
Oh, by the way, happy Father's Day / Grandfather's Day.
Okay, there you go. So... you know, I saw a lot of cool cars, and I could imagine owning them.
Easily.
Yeah, like, and that's not, like, that's not a vision.
No.
I mean, I saw a picture in my head of various cars, and me sitting in them with the wind blowing, and
it's like... Your hair going...
Well, it's like, what is that? Is that a vision? Like, is that a... I mean, I suppose...
It's a fantasy.
Well, okay, fantasy. Kind of I had is. Not written it's, down the word fantasy.
Yeah, that's
a good related
you
word.
You get that one for free.
There you go. Thank you. You're fantasy. Welcome. Yeah. Fantasy. Yeah, so desire, dream.
Dream.
Preferred outcome, mental picture of success. I don't know. Fantasy is a good one. You know, those are all kind of like, all right, those all fit in the word vision somewhere, somehow. And as a business owner, if you're going, hey, folks, I wish our business was like this, you know, the boots on the ground people are going to be like, we're following a real doofus. You know, I mean, where'd that guy get his vision card? Like, well, from the bubblegum machine?
Well, you say it that way, it sounds kind of whiny.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had more customers? you know, wouldn't it be nice if we had a great reputation? You know what I'm saying? I can imagine this business working better. Like, no, dude, no. That's not going to cut it.
No.
Doesn't cut it. So, now, I also wrote down, thought about, what are some opposite, and I didn't do a ton of, spend a ton of time thinking about this, but what are some kind of inverse, almost, words or concepts? And one of them was delusion, you know? So, you know, where you're just like, dude, I think you're seeing things. I think you're like having, you know, you're not seeing a picture of the future that we should all strive for. You have some obsession. Like you're, you know, fixation, I think, is one of those words. Fixation. I wrote about that, like fixation as a, in the book I wrote, Man Oh Man, a while back. I think I wrote about fixation in there. Fixation is like the sign that you are on the wrong path. You know, that it's one of those indicators that you should drop what you're doing. You know, and the state of being fixated, where you're like mesmerized and hypnotized, you know, and like, and you see this sometimes in, well, so my son's got this dog. That is it's a hunting dog. He's he's a good dog. Apache. You know, I tried to get him to name him Geronimo. And then, because I just thought that was a cool name for a dog. And then I thought, well, you know, just rugged and woodsy and tough, you know. And he wouldn't do it. So I'm like, well, how about Cochise? Because I was on this wild Apache Indian kind of idea. You know what I'm saying? He's like, nah, not Cochise. I'm like, all right, how about Apache? You know, and he's like, all right.
That works.
So that works. So everybody calls him Patchy, like patches or something. But it's like, no, it's an, well, it's Apache, yeah, but like he, the he, Comanche Indian type Apache.
He does kind of have patches on him.
He does. So, okay. But he's a hunting dog, and he's got this inbred or bred into him or in and he has an indwelling natural trigger. Instinct.
I was going to say instinct.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
And when we go out in the field, woods, whatever, if you're carrying a gun, he goes crazy. Like, he loses it. I mean, he becomes fixated. And he cannot see straight. Like, it, something happens, and his instinct kicks in, and he just, he can't listen. He can't focus. He goes into this maniac mode. And he loves it. I mean, he's really into it. And he's really bad at it, though. He is not a good hunting dog. So he's a blue tick hound, which is a really great hunting dog for coons and squirrels and, you know, varmints running around. I don't know about birds, but anyway, he's a hunting dog.
So he has this kind of instinct, but it's not honed.
It's right. It is latent and raw. It's it is not helpful.
But maybe with a little training.
Yeah, maybe when he was a pup or
right,
something.
Right, it's
maybe
too late now.
It's a little late. The die is cast. Oh, you boy. Know what I'm saying? Oof. But that, so that, that's an example of fixation. You know, where you can see, like, nothing is getting through. Like, you know, it's like, hello. You know, anybody in there?
Nope.
You know? And so fixation, like, you meet people that are fixated on stuff. And it's just like, oh, we're not getting through to you, are we? We might as well just stop right here. And I use it on myself. I'm like, man, if I'm fixated on something like, you know, some particular trip or snack or purchase or whatever, it's like, dude, you're about to make a big mistake. You know, no matter what it is that you're fixated on, you have like checked out and you've set aside the best parts of you, your decision-making components. And you're about to just like do some instinct thing, and it's probably going to be stupid. You know what I'm saying? And so fixation as a key indicator of stupidity for myself. You know, this isn't like I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just going, oh, I've noticed this. When I look back on some of the dumbest stuff I've done.
What? There's a long list.
Well, sure. You know. I'm 50 something. Right. What am I, 53?
My list is very long.
Yeah, sure.
So, like, to be honest.
I have plenty of time to screw that up. Right. You know, and right. check so that was, box. Right.
All right, there you go.
So anyway, so I've noticed in some of my worst decisions, there's a common theme, which is fixation.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
The state of being mesmerized by some imaginative la-la land mm-hmm. nothingness that is unattainable, that's unwise to try to attain, mm-hmm. right? That is outside of all sanity. But it's this burning picture in my mind, you know? So that's not a good vision. Mm. Right? That's kind of the opposite. Also, obsession. Another one that is so interesting. So at the Father's Day car show, mm-hmm. the weather was perfect. I mean, there was no...
It was so nice this weekend.
In Northeast Ohio in the summertime, a lot of times it's humid or rainy or whatever.
We don't get a lot of those kind of days.
Man, it was like, what was it? 65, yeah. Zero humidity, or like 10%. It's blue skies, turquoise.
7 to 10 miles per hour wind.
It was like... It was fairy tale mm-hmm. weather, mm-hmm. you know? So I'm walking along in fairy tale weather, looking at these fairy tale cars mm-hmm. that... nobody should own. I mean, it's like, I, you know, in my top car, if I could have, well, so my son Tristan was like, hey, Dad, what if you made a wish list of the five cars you wish you were driving? And I'm like, well, Tristan, we're sitting at A&W before the car show, like a few days before, having a...
And what's great is to combine those two things.
Oh, dude, yeah, absolutely.
A&W car show.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Car hop or, you know, mm. all that, like the hot dog on the window thing. And it's great. It's mm-hmm. just like very nostalgic. Mm-hmm. But the point is that fair weather, like when you're in that really nice, and you could use fair weather as a style or as a platform mm-hmm. or as a canvas. Mm. You know, anytime you do paint a painting on the fair weather canvas, all right. Well, then when the storms come by, all of a sudden you're like, I think I'm out. You know, I think I'm done here. You know, they say fair weather fans, right? They're fans that love the team when the team's doing good, when things are looking up, you know. And it's easy to have a vision when it's fair weather. It's easy to kind of be at a car show in the really nice weather and go, I think I should purpose to have one of these cars.
But you're not thinking about...
Yeah,
how the car got to that place in the
first place. About
all the work that went into it.
Yeah. It's completely
the
just
money.
It's eye candy.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying. It's cocaine mm-hmm. for the ego mm-hmm. or something, and it's a really bad idea.
Sure.
Unless you have a lot of things going on. Now, mm-hmm. if you're gonna purpose and spend your life going, hey, I'm gonna work on one of these cars. Great. You know, I'm not bashing that. I'm just saying. That I got a vision, and it was dumb, like, and it was unworthy for me to follow. So if mm-hmm. I came rolling into the shop and like, Shane, our new vision is, you know, 62 Corvette Stingray black with the top down, mm-hmm. you know, he'd be like, well, that sounds like a good idea, but a bad destination or bad, you know, like, that sounds nice, but that's, you know, I think that's a distraction.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
To put it lightly.
So anyway, so fair weather stuff, like visions can often come out of just rosiness mm-hmm. and they're not great visions. So mm-hmm. anyway, so we're going to talk more about visions. In a business sense, mm-hmm. so if you have an organization and you're developing or you have a vision, you need to develop a vision perhaps, or you have the roots to a vision, I want to talk about what some of those roots are. Now, in this podcast that Andy Stanley was talking about envisioning some components of a vision. And one of the things he kind of talked about was... a little bit of kind of pain. Like there has to be a bit of a impetus the vision is because something isn't quite right, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought about that. I'm like, yeah, you know, so in a business sense, you're like, you know what? I'm sick of this being this way.
I want it to be this way. I
want it
way.
To be that way right, for right. all these good reasons.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, you know, frustration can be the root to a vision, and pain, failure, extreme dissatisfaction, tyranny, you know? So, so the founding fathers are like, doggone it. Like, this isn't right. And we're going to do something about it. And we're going to, and they had a vision in their mind where it's like, this is what it should look like. What we're seeing now is not, well, not now, now. You could maybe argue
right.
a little bit, depending on
that's for a your separate angle. Podcast, maybe.
Maybe. So, but the founding fathers, you know, and their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, you know, so you take somebody like, I don't know, John Adams. Great miniseries, by the way. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's fabulous. It's like 10. Paul Giamatti is the, it plays John Adams and his wife, is it Abigail? No, Abigail, I think.
I don't remember.
Abigail Adams? I don't remember his wife's name. I can't remember the actress's name, but she's a really good actress. She's in a bunch of stuff. Anyway, it's a great miniseries, and it's on, based on that book by McCullough, the historical writer. So it's based, he has a book called John Adams. Anyway, miniseries is great. It's like 10 episodes. I think it's 10 or 15 years old. I don't remember who put it out, but a very, very good miniseries. And they go through his whole kind of early career all the way up to his death. Interesting little factoid about John Adams, by the way, is so John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were on, had kind of opposing opinions earlier in their, so just after the Revolution, kind of during and after the Revolution, for, 25 years, they weren't antagonists, but they didn't get along. And they were opposing, they were opponents for the presidency. I think it was, wasn't he the second president? John Adams was the second president. Yeah. So he was in Washington's cabinet, so was Jefferson. And they conflicted for the presidency. And John Adams, and they elected the president in a weird way at that point. I think it was like, not Congress, but somehow they didn't like vote for him. They sort of kind of almost got like appointed almost. But anyways, they were campaigning. And I'm butchering the whole historical how they got elected thing. But
we're going to get a lot of comments on this one.
Yeah, great. You know, great. Put your comments below. So, yeah, they didn't get along. And then I think it was the third, Jefferson, then I believe was the third president, right? So
yeah, I'm looking stuff up as we're going here.
Anyway, toward the end of their life, like after they both kind of like sort of retired, if you will, from politics and so forth and from helping found the country, saying it like in the form of politics isn't right. They really were activists. They were really kind of builders. And they kind of sort of retired and they became great buddies and wrote prolifically to one another in the last maybe 5 years of their life. And they both died on the same day on
that.
July 4th, like 1820 something. Their relationship got more and more rich and flowery in the letters. And it was really neat, neat history. So, but all that to say, vision's a big deal. And those guys, for example, had a vision for the business, for the country, mm-hmm. for the nation. They had a vision for a self-governed people that started a country based on the laws of nature and nature's God. Mm-hmm. It was kind of the phrase they used, one of the phrases they used. As in to say, you know, hey, you've got these inalienable rights, which means if somebody ignores them, that's their problem.
It's
they're
still
in there anyway,
right?
They're inalienable.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not granted by government. They're granted by the laws of nature and nature's God,
mm-hmm.
However you may see that, perhaps. But anyway, so that was what they were seeing, and they did a really good job writing about it, talking about it, painting a picture of it,
mm-hmm.
Casting, if you will, a vision to a whole people, most of a whole people, not everybody in the colonies was bought in to the revolution or the new country.
Mm-hmm.
Another great book that I've read a couple times is The Real George Washington. And you see, one of the things you see in there, it kind of chronicles George Washington through his whole life, through almost exclusively through letters. So you're getting a direct, it's not so much opinion about George Washington. You're getting like, hey, this is what he thought.
Mm-hmm.
This is what he said. This is who he said it to. This is what this person said to him. Then this is what he did after they said that. You know, so it's very direct. Anyway, during the Revolution, in this book, The Real George Washington, you see, and the author points out that, especially at Valley Forge, this is where it became really clear. Valley Forge, they were starving to death, literally starving, freezing, like thousands. I think they had, I want to say there's like 8,000 or 10,000 troops, maybe, and something like 2,000 of them froze or starved,
mm-hmm.
that winter. Just tragic. And I'm like, why wasn't anybody sending them food and clothes? You know, the troops would renew every year. They would renew their commitment. They said they had a 1-year commitment. And it was really hard to get to rebuild. Every year, Washington had to completely rebuild and retrain the army, the Continental Army. Anyway, during this time period, the surrounding villages and towns were selling the food that they raised to the British for gold instead of selling it to the Americans because of the inflated continental money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what they called the money at that point, but it was like, man, I didn't realize that there was really only a fraction. I think it was a third of the colonists, if I remember right from this book, were really bought in, mm-hmm. to the idea of, hey, we're starting a new country. A third of the colonists were ambivalent and just kind of like, eh, whatever. You know, we'll see how this turns out.
Mm-hmm.
And a third of the colonists were antagonistic and were like, I'm all for England. We're English. This whole thing's a bad idea. I'm going to sell you out to the British. I'm going to sell my food to the British. I'm going to, you know, whatever. And I didn't realize how problematic the time period was, you mm-hmm. know, and from our education and childhood and all that. It got painted as, isn't this neat? We had this rosy thing from July 4th. And when we were kids, we had the 200th anniversary.
Right. Bicentennial.
The bicentennial.
Mm-hmm.
And it was super patriotic. And I remember just thinking, America, you know, you know, it was very, like, I got that picture painted big time.
Yeah, we had.
We had a great country. And I think we do. I'm not doubting that we do. But anyway, I was a little shocked to me that, not everybody felt that way. Mm-hmm. Not only not everybody, only a third of the folks felt like, man, this is so cool. This whole idea of this nation, I'm willing to sign up for it. I'm really willing to carry a flintlock rifle and nearly starve, or, you know, put my fortune and my reputation on the line for this nation. And in order to do that, you got to have a compelling vision. I mean, somebody, this is right. not just an imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not a fair weather deal. And the Valley Forge thing is a great example of the opposite of fair weather fans.
Right.
Like, they're like,
it was bad.
Hey, General, the weather really sucks here. Yeah. You know, it's like 10 below. And some of the guys, I think like half of the guys had blankets. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. 10 below, slumped under some canvas tent.
Mm-hmm.
What without a blanket, you know, some of the guys, a lot of guys didn't have shoes. They were cooking up leather items to make soup, like with their belts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were eating tree bark. I mean, in the middle of civilization, you know, this is, mm-hmm. they weren't stuck in, you know, the Alps, you know, they weren't snowed in. This is not the Donner Party. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That wasn't the Alps, I know, but, you know, anyway, it's like, this is our nation's army that we slung together, and yet a lot of folks were not supporting it
mm-hmm.
because they didn't have the vision. They didn't see it. They were not bought in. So, visions have to come from, well, let me back up. So, compelling visions, rich, meaningful visions that are worth being committed to come from a solid foundation of some sort that has to do with extreme need, you know, tyranny. That's what kind of led me on that little tangent, tyranny,
mm-hmm.
you know, extreme dissatisfaction, pain, frustration, also epiphany, like, oh my gosh, we've been going along this way. And it could be really, really better. This actually doesn't work. That way would work. You know, so Steve Jobs, great example of that. He was mm-hmm. really good at saying, hey, this is dumb. Like, we can do it way better. And everybody will love it. And wouldn't that be great to have a device that does this?
The Sony Walkman.
Yeah.
The guy came in with a piece of wood this big, and I want it to be this size. And they're like, we can't do that.
Well, you're fired. I'll find somebody who
this
can.
This is the vision.
Right?
It needs to be this size.
Yeah, I think
make it happen.
Steve Jobs did that a lot where he would say, here's how I want it to be. And a guy would go, I can't do that. And then Steve Jobs would be, thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
I will go find somebody who can. Who thinks they can, or at least is willing to give it their sporting
right.
best.
The old college try.
The old college try, yeah. So
there's story after story of that where someone's I want this,
and
they have to figure it out.
Yep. Yeah, well, so Eddie Money did a great job painting a picture. And I remember as a kid hearing that song, and I remember thinking, well, where is that? You know, two tickets to where now? Because I had no idea what a vacation was. Yeah, I'm sure you didn't. Did you have a working vernacular of the word vacation, you know, as a kid?
It was pretty sketchy.
Yeah.
I mean, we were poor. So.
Yeah. And I remember.
Mom would try to take us to places, and that was vacation.
Yeah.
But that's even.
I remember. My neighbors went to Disneyland, the one in Florida. What's that, Disneyland?
That's Disney World.
Disney World?
Yeah.
Okay.
Disneyland's out west.
Out west. All right, there you go.
Anaheim.
And I remember they were gone for weeks. And they were, you know, you probably never met them. Dan and Doug Smith lived next door. Yeah. Did you meet them?
Yeah, we went water skiing.
Oh, with Doug. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Well, so... they lived next door, and they moved when I was probably 10 or something. I don't know. But they had gone on this trip,
mm-hmm.
and they were gone for weeks. And
or did it seem like weeks, or was it really?
No, it was weeks. I mean, they drove to Florida.
Okay,
I think it was a two-week trip.
Yeah, right.
And they came back with, like, stuff.
you know?
And as souvenirs.
As an 8-year old, you're like, what is this magical thing? You've
hoard.
Got, right? Yeah. And you have all these things you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I remember specifically they had these glass mugs that were tchotchkes, you know, mm-hmm. what I'm saying? From Disney, what? Disney World?
Was it shot glasses or
no,
was it?
No, they were more like almost like the A&W mugs. They right. were they That's were cool. they were like, I don't know, big mm-hmm. glass, big like I don't know, mugs.
Yeah,
Bierstein
sure.
mug type mm-hmm. glass, but they were glass. And I was like, I remember as a kid, just like, where is this, Matt? What is this thing, vacation, that you mentioned? You know, it sounds glorious. And and around that time, this song came out,
yeah.
you know, somewhere in there. And I remember just going, this is so interesting, but I don't have any context
for it. It's
just
very foreign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, somewhere around there, I was 8 or 9 or 10, we all piled as my four brothers, and we piled in the station wagon. Of course, and I'm fourth of five.
So
I'm in the back.
With the fumes.
With Andy, yeah. my younger brother. And, you know, we saw the whole, there's a great Brian Regan skit about, you know, station wagons and so forth, riding in the back, you know, watching the eastern half of the United States go by backwards. Anyway, we drove to Connecticut. So this is from Ohio to Connecticut. My mom had a cousin that lived in Springfield, Connecticut, where the Springfield Armory is, mm-hmm. New Haven,
mm-hmm.
New Haven, Connecticut. And here I got these revolutionary references again. And mm-hmm. there's the Springfield Armory popped up somewhere around, I think it was 1812, or it's early though
mm-hmm.
in our nation. Anyway, we drove by it. It's cool. And that was, I think, the first time we took a vacation, and it was like 4 or 5 days over Thanksgiving, and it was a lot of driving and mm-hmm. a lot of stress, and hung out at my mom's cousin's house. I'm like, well, this is it, you know.
My wife's family would go on vacation, and her dad would always quit smoking that week.
What? It's such a weird thing.
No.
Why? It was just like a tradition?
For some reason, that happened a lot. He would be going through issues.
Right.
Not
He'd
smoking,
be grumpy.
Right.
Oh, man.
So that just colored the whole vacation week.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
It's kind of funny, though.
Well, so Eddie Money is like, hey, we got two tickets to paradise. He paints a picture in a song of paradise, of and he's saying to the missus, hey, we're going off to, I'm guessing, some tropical island, you know, Hawaii, I don't know, Bahamas.
Somewhere in the Bahamas, here.
Yeah. And we're going to, you know, do this thing we always dreamed of. And so now the visionary, well, so let me back up. I'm going to talk about the visionary dilemma here in a minute. And I'm working on a book called The Visionary Dilemma. And I'm going to tell you in a minute about the visionary dilemma. But first of all, I want to quote, I'm not going to quote, I want to reference a book called The Survivor's Club
mm-hmm.
by Ben Sherwood. And this is seems like a tangent, all right? But it's not. It's a book about the science of surviving really dire, like plane crash, you know, stranded on a boat, lost in the woods, you know, those kind of survival scenarios. And this guy, Ben Sherwood, goes and looks at all of these, a bunch of these situations, and documents what differentiates the survivor from the non-survivor. And he picks these scenarios where there were both, where we can go, oh, here are these 10 people. 9 of them didn't survive. This one did. Why? Mm-hmm. What happened? Like, what, you know, is there something, is there a common thread between survivors? And he found it. And it's a well-known and survival circles, I guess, that the folks who survive are not the folks who are the most prepared. They're not the folks who have the best physique for survival. they were not the folks who were the best trained. Even being an adult or a child, like you'd think, hey, we got this 12-year-old kid and this 32-year-old. And it's like, nope, not that. You'd think that I put my chips on a 32-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Nope, it's not that either. You know, I'm like, huh. So it was all about the folks who survived had a reason. They had someone to survive for. Mm. And they just kept thinking, I've got to make it for them. And they had in their mind this burning picture of why they were going to survive.
I literally saw that on TV the other day.
Yeah.
There's this guy that his arms were blown off in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that all I thought about was if I could just stay awake and I want to get back to my wife.
Yeah. Yep. Just got, you got,
it, he had it's this, a, he that's just a kept vision. Thinking about it over and over and over.
Yep. That's a vision. Mm. So this one particular guy, there was this plane crash, and it was in the, over the Amazon, in the jungle. And this like 12-year-old girl, I think it was like 3 weeks or something. She like wound her way through and cause she had this picture in her head, like, I gotta get to see, I don't remember the details, but I gotta see my mom or something, you know? And there was this, these burly tough, you know, dudes that didn't make it, you know? And, there was this shipwreck, and all these folks were on this life raft, and all these like tough, burly, smart sailor, swimmer type folks like freaked out. They would literally start swimming off. They'd get off the life raft and they'd start to have delusions. And like, I think the shore's over there. And off they go. They talk themselves into it and they swam off and got eaten by, you know, because there's sharks swimming around because they're floating. They're like, hey, what's that floating there?
That's, you know? That's lunch.
That looks yummy. So, and you know, people couldn't keep their heads on straight, you know? And, anyway, so very, very interesting.
That is.
So another one, another good reference to, and these are intense. All right. This is not, for the faint of heart, so to speak. But Viktor Frankl, great book, fabulous book he wrote called Man's Search for Meaning. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And in that he's a Holocaust survivor. I think he's Austrian. And it's not a book, and he writes in the book and says, this is not a book about the Holocaust. You know, this is not like, and the Germans did this and Hitler, you know, whatever. It's not about that. He's a psychiatrist. I think he's a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I can't remember which. He's one of them. I think he's a psychiatrist, though. Was. And because he was a, quote, doctor, he got pigeonholed once he was put in one of the famous, I don't remember, it's Dachau or Auschwitz. I think it might have been Auschwitz, but I can't recall. He got, like, on doctor duty. Like, oh, you're a doctor, huh? You know, and he's like, well, yeah, I'm a psychiatrist. And so he started to, like, man the, they had, like, a sick ward, if you will. And, like, okay, isn't that the whole place? I mean, welcome to Auschwitz, the sick ward. You know, I mean, it's like, but imagine being in Auschwitz and going, I think I got to go to the sick ward. I'm like, dude, you're living in it.
Yeah.
Man, intense. So he started making these observations about the people who were, I'm not going to say, use the word happy, because nobody was happy, but they survived and maintained their dignity and maintained their meaning, their sense of meaning. And he started to kind of, gather observations about these folks who maintain their sense of dignity, their sense of kind of propriety, their sense of love, of self-worth, and a sense of meaning. And what it was there, they had a reason to live, and they had and it was something that the Nazis couldn't take from them, you know, and it was down inside. And it was really meaning. Like they were like, I am this, I am this, I'm that, I'm beauty, purpose, truth. Some of those big heavy duty words. And it's a great, great book. And he developed a therapy or a practice, some sort of modality of psychiatry, or is it psychology? I don't know which.
He was a psychiatrist.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So he developed this, and I don't remember what it's called, but a practice. And the second half of the book is basically like, all right, here's this thing I developed from this experience. And and it's really interesting. It is one of those must-read books, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl. So now, that being said, I want to reference a third book, which is Drive by Daniel Pink. And this is all getting down to, okay, what the heck is a vision? And is it good or not? Or what should it be? Or how do you make it? Or how do you, why? Or, you know, all that stuff. And let's not make a dumb, squashy money vision. Money's not a good vision. Now, some of you are going like, what? Yeah, no. But, you know, if you don't agree, then you're on the wrong podcast. I'm just saying. You might want to, as they say in poker, you might want to check your hold card, you know, or your, you know, your pocket card. So, Daniel Pink, Drive, great book. I talked about it a couple different times here and there. Read it a number of times, and I've pulled a tool out of there, developed a tool, and we've referenced this, I think, before on the podcast. And our tool that we've developed, we call it M3M. And it is a hack for an entrepreneur or an organizational leader to say, okay, how do I motivate my people? Big buzzword, motivation. Engagement is one of the current kind of vernacular around getting folks motivated. Okay, are they engaged? What's their engagement level? Gallup measures engagement and so forth, does all these surveys. And so M3M, simple tool, which is what is meaning? What is motivation? What is motivation? So that's the first M. So motivation equals these three M's. And so you to develop, stimulate, grow, fertilize, however you want to call it, create motivation. You've got to work in these three areas, and they're all M's. All right, and I took one of his and turned it into an M, so I could have this.
Yeah, nifty, but you tool, still talk about it.
M3M. So the first one is meaning. All right, meaning is motivating. Meaning drives people, and this is from the Survivor Club. This is from Viktor Frankl. This is from all sorts of observant people have seen that, yes, indeed, meaning is very, very motivating. And it's primal, if you will. The second motivator is mastery. And that is this idea of getting a little better and a little better and a little better and taking what you did and going, like, that was really good, but I messed up this and that, so now I'm going to make that a little better. And you're just constantly aiming for, you could use the word artistry as well, you know, where you're taking what you're good at and you're finding joy in being a little better and just kind of standing back and going, man, that was great. Because, well, then the car show is a great example of that. You know, you see all these folks with all these spectacular specimens of cars, and you're like, man, Ford really nailed it when they made that Mustang in 1967. You know, or, well, the Shelby. So Tristan's number one car is Shelby.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
that's really nice.
So, and then you see these cars that, and the people are sitting by them going, I painted that, you know, I polished that. Mm-hmm. I, you know, look how this and that sparkles and shines. Mm-hmm. And you're like, man, you're really something, aren't you? You know, there's like joy, there's satisfaction that comes from mastery. Mm-hmm. And that's what Daniel Pink points out in Drive. Like, hey, you've got to develop a opportunity for folks to master their craft. Mm-hmm. And if you don't give folks an opportunity and they just need to work, make money, sell, fill, and then go home. Like, well that sucks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually anti-human. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like eating soda pop cans. It doesn't jive with our digestion. No, it's not human, right?
Right.
Like, I am not a robot, you know? Have you ever seen the cartoon Robots?
I don't remember.
It's very funny. Robin Williams is the voiceover for the main guy.
Oh.
It's a really good movie. There's some really good stuff in there. Yeah. Anyway, they eat stuff, not
metal
cans and stuff. So the third M, so meaning, mastery, and then the third one is autonomy.
Motonomy.
Like, well, no, that won't work. So
you mean the third letter's
not
money?
No, it's not money.
Oh.
Yeah, imagine that.
Yeah.
And he talks about why.
Yeah, but
why money is a bad motivator. Money, it has to, you have to have an appropriate transaction.
Yeah.
But it's, if you use money to try to stimulate buy-in, you'll get this other thing.
Which is
no bueno.
But what is autonomy?
So autonomy is...
Realist back in here.
Yeah. So autonomy is... and I switched that to mine.
Yes.
Because I'm like, I needed an M.
Yeah.
I couldn't do motonomy. So nobody would get it. So so speaking of Stan Hewitt, mm-hmm. So I use this little way to describe autonomy to a client. It's the English garden. Mm-hmm. So the idea of an English garden.
Right.
And again, we're painting a picture. Mm-hmm. Right? We're just going, okay, you know what an English garden is? Yeah, I do. That's autonomy. What do you mean? Well, so as the maybe, I don't know, estate owner in an English garden scenario, you might say to a kid, hey, this will be your garden. I'm going to put up this wall, stone wall, brick wall, beautiful wall, and there will be this gate. And it creates isolation, not as in loneliness isolation, but it isolates this plot of soil from the rest of it. It mm-hmm. creates, it makes it special, all right? It makes it kind of like, it designates it for a different purpose.
Mm-hmm.
All right, first of all. So you build a wall around it. A beautiful wall, not a, you know, prison wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to keep things from messing with it. All right. And it's also to say, to create a defined canvas where like, all right, this is going to be, this is your place to work. And it creates focus, mm-hmm. right? It creates a hard, tangible, and when I say hard, I mean not squashy or mm-hmm. soft or mm-hmm. wispy, but concrete or tangible, mm-hmm. tactile place mm-hmm. for the person. So first of all, you build a wall, and then you put a gate on it, and so there's permissions
mm-hmm.
on the gate side, and you say put on the outside like, hey, the only requirements I have are these two or three or four, just a handful. I need this and this and this to happen. Maybe these results were after such and such a result. And then what do you need from me? Like, I'll provide all of the supplies. And what you provide is the creativity and it's your place. It's like your sandbox. And that's autonomy. Like, mm-hmm. I'll stay out of your way. If you need some help or some training or some guidance or somebody else to come in and coach or teach or if you need this other tool or you need another load of dirt or whatever, you know, hey, I'm having trouble with aphids. Okay. Well, here's this book or something. Yeah, I'll give you whatever you need. to produce said results, but I'll stay out of your kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's autonomy. And if we have the right person, well, they'll take that and it'll motivate them. Now, if we put somebody in there who doesn't have a green thumb, that's our problem as a manager. Like, we stuff this thing up this person's nose and they're like, this is not my sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that idea still is to give them clear parameters,
mm-hmm.
give them what they need, and then stay the heck out of their way. And just let them do it. Let them own the results. And the right person for that spot, it's going to really create value for them. It's going to check a box down in their soul.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually very kind of a manager, leader, to provide those places. That's part of the meaningful role inside of leading, owning, managing is you're creating these spaces where people can flourish.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of stand back and go, yeah, I did that. You know, that guy and this gal and that guy, they're having a great life because I built a job for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And my son-in-law is experiencing this right now. He got a new job. Little shout out here to Apollo Heating and Cooling.
Yeah, there you go.
Kent, Ohio. Apollo Heating and Cooling. They have built a really fabulous business, and my son-in-law works there. And, dude, he is like a kid in a candy shop. Like, he comes, he leaps out of bed. He lives next door,
mm-hmm.
him and my daughter,
yeah.
and my two of my five grandkids live on my property and in another house. And he leaps. He's so excited. And they come over often, daily, multiple times a day, and which is really fun. And my granddaughters and, you know, whatever. So, and a lot of times, if I'm home at this point, he'll stop over when he gets home and just, he's excited. He's like, man, and he'll talk about, I love my job. I love this. I love that. I've never loved a job before. And I love this. And I'm just like, man, these guys have built this job for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's making his life worth living
mm-hmm.
in some area that he's never experienced.
Yeah.
And it's really cool.
That's fun to watch.
Yeah, it's really cool. And he's not making much money. But now with the last job, it was all about the money. He was making $5 an hour more at the last job.
Mm-hmm.
And all he could do was complain. And he just like, well, maybe I should try to make some more money. Maybe I'm going to go talk to the boss, see if he'll pay me more. And it just became money driven.
Which wasn't motivating.
That's all he had. You know, that's all he could find of substance
mm-hmm.
in the job, you know. So going back to casting a vision is a business owner, and we're focusing on the folks who own whether it's a nonprofit or a for-profit, the folks who own the culture. And maybe they own the business. Often those are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The person who owns the culture also owns a business. Now, look, if you own the business and you don't own the culture, but somebody else does, you need to pull the boss off to the side of the road and rethink about it. Actually, you should call me. and I'm going to help you get back in the driver's seat.
Contact info.
So we used to say we dragged the business owner out from under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine his legs sticking out, going, ah, you know, and put him back in the driver's seat. So anyway, yeah, so casting a vision. So here's the visionary dilemma. First of all, the first part of this dilemma, and there are three, and I'm writing a book about this, that is full of tools and ideas and kind of unearthing what the heck vision even means or mm-hmm. is or what you should do about it as a leader. Let's say you got 37 employees, you know, and all right, I need to cast a vision. Right. So this book will help you figure that out. So the first part of the dilemma, because there is a dilemma, once you're kind of like, oh, I got a vision. Okay, now, the first wall you're going to run smack into, all right?
Hard,
is that you're casting a vision for people that don't know vision is a thing. They're saying to themselves, we need that? You know, folks need a vision?
I'm just coming here to work.
This sounds interesting, but I didn't know I needed... I'm plodding along in my life, and I didn't know I needed a vision. Mm-hmm. You know, and so people need a vision, but they don't know that they need a vision. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, people need vitamin C, you know, or mm-hmm. or whatever, but vitamin whatever, mm-hmm. But they don't know it often. I'm like, oh, I was missing that? You know, that's why I'm so sick or whatever. And that's not, you know, it's not unusual that there are significant primal things that we need mm-hmm. that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. You know, that is not a newsflash, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? But vision is one of those things. Mm-hmm. You know, folks need a vision for life. Solomon, son of David, writer, one of the writers of the book of Proverbs in the old Bible, which is my favorite, you know, book, by the way. If you were to say, hey, there's 66 of them in there, well, the first one I want, if I can only pick one, is Proverbs. Mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, not that that's it, but I'd be like, cool, just give me Proverbs. Mm-hmm. So he says, without a vision, people perish. You know, I was like, oh, so if you don't actually have this big picture of where you're going to end up for these good reasons that are going to help take you from here to here to here, and life will be worth living and better for you or for your family or for your community, or then you're just going to die. Mm-hmm. You're just going to like wither into nothingness, which is really morbid, but unfortunately,
yeah,
true. Mm-hmm. I think. So without a vision, people perish. So that's the first dilemma. The first dilemma you're going to run smack into as a visionary, as a person who goes, I have this place I'm trying to take my organization to, mm-hmm. and you start talking to folks about it, and they're like, well, I ordered a cheeseburger. I just, you know, I don't, what is this thing vision that you're talking about, boss? You know, because it's lunchtime, and, you know, I got things to do, you know, other than listen to you talk about your dumb vision.
This is really hitting home here.
Is it? What? You're not getting a vision for Lodestone? Oh, it's lunchtime.
No, it's getting to be lunchtime, yeah. And you're talking about it.
Yeah, Shane's like, stomach's over there. I'm like, oh, can we go get a cheeseburger? Can we call somebody?
This cheeseburger thing is sounding really good.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the first part of the dilemma. So you start casting your vision for your folks, and they're confused right away because it's not something they think about. Mm-hmm. They don't know they need it. They don't think about it. They're kind of maybe a little shocked that there's this thing called vision. Okay, so although we're wired for it, and they're not too shocked, but you just got to start kind of going, oh, my folks aren't used to hearing this, and they're really used to perhaps not having a vision. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. For any part of their life, for their kids, for their finances, for their health, for their schedule, for their community, you know, for their nation, right? We just sort of like, what do you do for a job? You know what I mean? We're just kind of like...
kind of winging it.
We sink down in these small little worlds, mm-hmm. and we adapt, and that's mm-hmm. not bad. Adapting, though, can be toxic. We have this toxic ability to adapt to something that we should change.
Right.
That's not good. Mm-hmm. So that's the first dilemma. The second dilemma is that visions are invisible. They're pictures that no one can see but you as the visionary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you're like, hey, I'm going to start explaining this vision. And, you know, in your mind, you're like, I see it as I explain it. So you're talking to your kids, let's mm-hmm. say. You know, if that's a great example. Like, well, hey, kids, we're going to sell this house and buy this other one for these. Because in your mind, you're like, I see it. Mm-hmm. And your kids are like, what about my school? And what about my friends? And what about my bedroom? And what about, right? And right. they don't see it. They don't see it at all. They're Ooh. All they hear is move, mm-hmm. right? Or, right? And so you're casting, you're painting a picture that nobody can see. And it's really hard mm-hmm. to paint an invisible picture.
Right.
It's really, it's not very easy. Mm-hmm. So that's a dilemma. Mm-hmm. Seeing something in your mind's eye is good, is important, is vital. But then to take that and make a communicable, accurately rich physical picture, mm-hmm. tangible picture. And in the book, I'm going to spell out a bunch of practical, logical ways to make a picture of your vision, mm-hmm. To get other people to go, oh, that's what you're talking about. You know, and pictures are a great example. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, this song, that song, you know, Two Tickets to Paradise helps paint a picture.
Right.
It's not total, but it helps. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so that's the second part of the dilemma, that pictures are, visions are invisible pictures. Now, what our goal is as a visionary is to do what I call putting clothes on the invisible man. You know, so there used to be this, like in the 60s, I think. But there's a book. There's a famous book yeah. called The Invisible Man,
yeah.
right? A novel. And anyway, so if you're like, in, you know, cartoons and stuff, you know, we grew up watching Looney Tunes.
Right.
And there's these different times in Looney Tunes. And this is what I thought of, actually, when I kind of came up with, oh, this is what I got to do is put clothes on the invisible man. You know, all the different times that, like, Sylvester would drink
some potion,
and he'd get invisible. Yeah. And then, you know, Tweety Bird would spill paint on him, mm-hmm. or he would walk through something and something would stick to him, mm-hmm. you know, of course, and or Elmer Fudd or whatever. So we got to put clothes on the invisible man mm-hmm. here because you can't see him. And so, but when you drape something over him, he's like, oh, look, there's this outline that I can kind of see him now. And that's really the getting over that second hurdle, that mm-hmm. second dilemma is you've got to work really hard as a visionary to constantly paint and repaint and repaint this picture of this vision and get it out of your head and out into tangible reality.
The first time you paint it, it's just this blob.
Yeah. Right. And people don't understand it. No. You know, there's another saying I say all the time, 7 is the new one, mm-hmm. you know, which is, hey, the first time you say it, nobody's going to hear it. They don't hear stuff the first time. They hear it the 7th time, quote unquote.
When you watch someone
be confident.
When you watch someone actually painting a picture, you have no idea what's going on. You're just That's seeing right. like some background stuff right. and
yep.
Then all of a sudden it starts to become clearer and clearer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Takes a while though.
Takes a while. That's right. So that's the second part of the dilemma. The third part of the visionary dilemma. So we hit the first one, boom, people don't know they need a vision. They hit mm-hmm. the second one, boom, second kind of hurdle or brick wall, which is visions are invisible pictures and difficult to communicate. Mm-hmm. The third brick wall is visions are disruptive. Visions change normalcy. Like you're saying, with by definition, you're saying where we are now is not okay.
Right.
We're going somewhere else. And so they disrupt. So people are like, whoa, you mean everything's going to change? I don't like that, you know, and you've got to have as an organizational founder, leader, developer, whatever you want to call it, business or nonprofit, by nature, you've got to fill the thing with people that love to come to work every day. And they love to be, you know, maybe stable. I mean, just, right? Rhythmic, regular. Like, that is a value add.
Sure.
All right? Absolutely. That is like, you don't want to hire a bunch of folks who are like, hey, I changed my mind, you know, because I'm just a free spirit. Well, that's great. But, that's not going to help you build your business. Mm. And so, as a visionary, you're plopping this vision down in front of people who are like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, what is this? What is this vision thing? Like, because I'm happy with my day job and I'm happy with the schedule and I get home at this time and the kids are this and, you know, I can hit Starbucks or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, they have this rhythm and it's good for them. It's not like and you're about to disrupt it. You're about to disrupt some element of their total existence and it's threatening. And a lot of times visionaries are like, well, so they're like, really? You know, it's not disrupting to a visionary. To a visionary, it's lifeblood. It's the nectar of life. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, here we go. You know, and to the folks who are like turning the crank, so to speak, they're exhausted. It's exhausting. It's overwhelming. It's threatening. It's exhausting. And the visionary's like, really? I mean, so we've got to, as a visionary, that's the third dilemma that you've got to take into account and be cognizant of, or you will screw it up. And your people will leave. The healthy ones will leave. And the unhealthy ones will stay, which is a double whammy. Because they can't get the courage up to leave your dumb organization, you know, with this dumb vision. Let's say it's 100 million, blah, blah, blah. You know, and they're like, shoot, I don't want to be part of that. But I got nothing better going on, so I'm going to stay. All right, and that's not good. Actually, for many reasons. So those are the three big, I see anyway, big truths or dilemmas around vision. So in this book I'm going to be working on soon, I'm working on it now, we will be spelling out a bunch of that. And here on the podcast, we're going to talk about elements of that as it's getting written. So I think I'm, I don't know, 12,000 words in. You're, I don't know where this thing's going exactly.
You're in deep, though.
I'm up to my neck, man. So, but no, I've got some really good tools and hacks and observations and case. So I'm going to call them case studies. They're really not. I mean, they're just like, well, I got this client who struggled here, here, and here with this, this, and that. Changed X, Y, Z, and now it's better.
Yeah.
So those are case studies, right? And that's what we're calling that. So there will be a lot of that in there. So there we go. That is a little snippet, if you will.
Yeah.
Episode 15, talking about the visionary dilemma. Building a paint a picture for, hey, where we're headed, paradise. You got another visionary song teed up? No? Just play the Eddie Money again.
That's what I was going to do.
Love that.
It's a good song.
Yeah. All right. Well, so hit us up on, you know, LinkedIn, and you're already listening to this. So
right.
I don't need to tell you about that.
Share it with your friends.
Sure. Yeah. LinkedIn is love to connect with you on LinkedIn. We've got some cool stuff going on coming up here at Lodestone True North. So meanwhile, good luck out there taking your business to the land of awesome. If you need some help, give me a call.
It does take a while to get to the chorus.
But it's worth the wait.
Yeah. Waiting for love.
love that little drum break. I mean, it's just nice. Simple.
Yeah.
And then it, coming up on the next chorus, that piano, what do you call it when you drag your finger? Glissando or
yeah.
something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's right.
Really cool little simple mini guitar solo here.
It's easy on the ears, for sure.
Nice little ride cymbal right there. Feel good. Dude, this is a top down, cruising along country road.
Yep.
62 Corvette.
Yep. Back to that again.
Yeah. Verse with no words.
I ran out of words.
Eddie, why don't you think about that for a minute? And we could probably come up with a third verse. Don't you think, Eddie? Oh no, I go.
Oh, here he goes.
Well, Eddie, that's what you said the first time. He was really good at like doing that, like spreading out phrases over what was that triplet. Quarter notes, right?
Yep.
Anyway, he's saying almost nothing, by the way.
There's...
which is kind of part of what a vision is. Now, here.
There you go.
Yeah. Glissando. All right, fun episode, buddy.
Good job.